Lecture 26, Language and the Brain.
When Descartes raised the question, this fascinating question, which we still address, we address it now in the context of artificial intelligence, the question of whether you could ever make a machine that so approximated, indeed even duplicated, the characteristics of a human being, that indeed you could not tell the two apart. Descartes had developed his reflex model of sensation, perception, and behavior. He had seen in the royal gardens these statues engaged in quite sophisticated patterns of movement. He thought that the entire animal economy, human beings included, at least in their ordinary sensations and movements, were engaged by essentially mechanical and hydraulic processes. And so the question that arises is whether you could actually achieve an essentially human kind of performance just by getting the machinery right. Well, Descartes concluded that there would always be three things that such an entity would never achieve, and that would allow you to distinguish between it and a genuine, rational human being. First, he says, such a device will never attain to the idea of God. Now, I don't want to pore over that one, whether any machine would attain to the idea of God. But this seems to be tied to the second criterion that Descartes offered, and that is that such a device would never be able to hold abstract conceptions. It would never be able to frame such abstract conceptions as one finds in, for example, abstract mathematics and dural science, theories of justice, that sort of thing. Thirdly, he says, it would never engage creatively in language. And I think the accent here, the stress here, should be laid to the adverb. Never be able to engage creatively in language. Descartes knew all about parrots. He knew all about parroting. He knew all about the imitative behavior even of very, very young children who otherwise did not have a passable language. But what Descartes has in mind is much more the sort of thing that Chomsky has in mind when he says that a competent native speaker can comprehend and produce a virtual infinity of intelligible and informing sentences, that there really is no limit to the linguistic competence, the creative linguistic competence of a native language speaker. And what Descartes wants to argue is that this is the sort of behavior you'd never be able to get out of a machine. So Descartes would not be surprised, I shouldn't think anyway, he wouldn't be surprised if we produce tape recordings and video recordings and the like, but to bring in a machine that actually generated in a creative way novel utterances, nonetheless meaningful and coherent and sound, that Descartes says is uniquely reserved to human beings. Now, in this, Descartes is part of a very, very long tradition, which I think we can say begins with Stoic philosophy, according to which our linguistic prowess is what separates us from the balance of the animal economy. That we, as language users, to use an expression that Stoics would have been quite at home with, form a common family. All language users can be viewed as members of a common family, a koine oikos, and the non-language user just falls outside this. And it's with Stoicism, circa 300 BC and thereafter, that you begin to see human beings as forming not just a distinguishable class of animals. After all, Aristotle knows that fish form a class and birds form a class and human beings form a class. But now human beings, not merely as a distinguishable class, but as a very, very special class, able to do things nothing else can do and that nothing else even approximates, do you see? Well, if you are part of a materialist tradition in psychology and are firmly won over to the view that indeed any definable psychological process finally refers to an underlying physiological process, then of all the processes you might be deeply interested in this regard, certainly language would be very, very high on the list. And as the human brain, at least on a gross examination, compared with the brains of apes, the brains of monkeys and the like, well, it's different, but you certainly, on inspecting it, don't see something there that is sort of flashing language, language, language. The question has long been whether our linguistic prowess really is reducible to something biological and physiological, or whether there's something quite transcendent involved, something that transcends the level Well, of course, debates on this raged, as you might guess, and in this area, as in so many areas, the first crack in the door, I say from the point of view of a developed psychobiology or physiological psychology, the first crack in the door comes with the famous patient studied by Dr. Broca in the 19th century. A few words about this patient. Not a person who was insane or feeble or in most outward respects unusual in any way at all, but nonetheless, this person could not utter a coherent sentence. Indeed, on countless opportunities, many, many interviews and clinical studies of the patient, the most Broca could ever get out of this one was the utterance, which in his language had no meaning at all, T-A-N, tan. He would just say things like tan. Broca would ask a question, and that's what would come back. So the person, for all practical purposes, was incapable of expressive language. He could follow things that Broca said. He could hand things over when Broca asked for them. He got to the clinic and got back home and the like. That is, he could live a reasonable life except for this profound deficit. He could not express himself in language. He had what is called today a Broca's aphasia, or an expressive aphasia. He could comprehend language, but he could not produce it. When this patient died, it became possible to perform a post-mortem and do a fairly close examination within the limits of 19th century techniques, do a fairly close examination of the brain, and what Broca discovered was that there was indeed a lesion. There was a region of brain that was destroyed, and that region of the brain was on one side of the body. It was on the left. It was in the left hemisphere in an area that's referred to as the third frontal convolution, and it's a region that we now refer to as Broca's area. It is not present on the other side, which is to say that a lesion on the corresponding point in the other hemisphere will not produce this deficit. And indeed, there's fairly good evidence to suggest that Broca's area is thus lateralized, even in people who are left-handed. We no longer say that language is uniquely associated with one side of the brain and not the other, but that it is disproportionately represented on one side, and that side tends to be, almost invariably is, the left hemisphere, the side that controls the right side of the body. So all right-handed people have their right-hand movements initiated by events taking place in the left hemisphere. Left-handed people, or any person who's using the left hand, will have those movements initiated by events taking place in the right cerebral hemisphere. There's a crossing over of function. The dominant hemisphere we refer to as the hemisphere controlling right-handed people. I, being a left-handed person, regard this as highly discriminatory, but nonetheless, that's the way it works. And Broca's area is in what is called the dominant cortex, and it is in a region of the cerebral cortex which actually is primarily association area. That is, if you take a look at the functions served by the cerebral cortex, as I mentioned in the previous lecture, there is a strip of cerebral cortex that is motor cortex and has the specific function, when activated, of moving specific parts of the body. There is a strip adjacent to this, the sensory cortex, which in fact is the cortical representation of the body surface. So when the body surface is touched, different parts of the body are touched, those stimuli, those events, ultimately are projected to discrete places along the sensory cortex. In the posterior of the cerebral cortex, we find the occipital lobes, primarily associated with visual function. The temporal lobes, the surface of the temporal cortex, includes areas primarily associated with auditory function. But there are large areas of the cortical surface that do not have specific sensory and motor functions, and these are referred to as association cortex. And Broca's area would fall within cortex. Now, aphasia is not the only disturbance in what might be called symbolic functions. There are persons with cortical lesions, and I think we want to be clear on what the term lesion means. L-E-S-I-O-N. A lesion is any pathological disturbance of tissue, any pathological process in tissue. It can be a tumor. It could be a vascular lesion. It could be as a result of a traumatic injury. It could be as a result of a surgical severing of pathways and the like. So lesion is just generic for a pathological process or something that seriously disturbs the normal functioning of an area. And I say, lesions in the cerebral cortex as a result of stroke, for example, or tumors, benign and malignant, anything that exerts pressure on a given region, can produce any number of disturbances in what we regard as symbolic functions. For example, the inability to write. The person can speak normally. The person can read written text, but cannot write it. Agraphia is the term of choice for that. There are some instances in which the most profound disturbance is referred to as acalculia. An otherwise perfectly normal person, cognitively adept at all sorts of tasks, cannot perform routine calculations. I mean the most trivial arithmetic calculations. That is a particular disturbance. More rarely, we have instances of what is called amelodia. And this is an instance in which the person's speaking ability may be entirely undiminished, reading ability, writing ability, but after this lesion, as a result of this insult to the nervous system, they are no longer able to detect the melodic qualities of sound. They're simply flat when it comes to the perception of musical melodies. Now, these are all symbolic or quite complex cognitive type functions, writing, calculating, the kind of relational perception associated with recognizing melodies, and of course, speech itself. And so we discover that these very, very rich psychological processes can be wiped out or very significantly diminished even by punctiform lesions in the cerebral cortex. It's really quite remarkable to see these effects. Now, posterior to Broca's area, and more lateral than Broca's area, is a region referred to as Wernicke's area. And Wernicke's area, when damaged or destroyed, when there is a lesion in Wernicke's area, the symptom pattern is quite different from what you get with a Broca's aphasia. Now you have a patient who can speak. Now, the speaking might be quite peculiar, but you do get whole patterns of sentences and paragraphs and the like. But there is not a comprehension of spoken prose. So what you have now is a kind of receptive aphasia. It's the read-in part of the system that's most seriously degraded rather than the expressive part. Now, in saying that a Wernicke syndrome patient is able to express himself or herself but has a receptive problem, I don't want to suggest that the expressive performance is invariably good. Let me give you a passage from a Wernicke syndrome patient studied by Professor Norman Geschwind, who was a leading figure in the area of brain mechanisms and language for many, many years at Harvard. The patient is shown a scene of a boy stealing cookies behind his mother's back, and the patient is asked to describe this scene. Now, this is a Wernicke syndrome patient, and this is what the patient says. Mother is away here working her work to get her better, but when she's looking, the two boys looking in the other part. She's working another time. Now, you have sentences here, and in fact they're complete sentences, and I haven't parsed these, but I think they're actually grammatical sentences. And indeed, there's a certain coherence to them. They're conveying some kind of meaning. But it is quite clear that the person uttering this sentence has some kind of cognitive and linguistic disturbance. So although it is the case that Wernicke syndrome often will spare the expressive capabilities of the speaker, very, very often, even in sparing these expressive capabilities, the syndrome includes certain telltale signs, certain utterances that surely the skilled clinician would give pause to the clinician. Now, one way we've advanced in our understanding of linguistic functions in relation to brain mechanisms has to do with a very, very peculiar set of phenomena arising when the interconnections between the two hemispheres are severed. Now, the two hemispheres are functionally and anatomically joined by rich fiber pathways running left and right and left and right, I say, and joining the two sides of the brain at several levels. The major interconnections are what join the two great cerebral hemispheres, and the band of fibers connecting the two great cerebral hemispheres are referred to collectively as the corpus callosum. Now, you might ask, under what conditions would anyone actually sever the callosal connections between the two hemispheres? Why and under what circumstances would one ever do this to a human being? You certainly don't perform experimental neurosurgery on even college sophomores, who otherwise are used for all sorts of research in psychology departments. Well, this surgical procedure has a quite interesting history, which I will summarize all too briefly. It begins with intractable epilepsies, that is, with forms of epilepsy that finally will not respond to medication. Indeed, the first use of this surgery was with great trepidation, but in the face of the fact that absent something radical, the very life of the patient was in jeopardy. Now, in forms of epilepsy that might lend themselves to this surgical procedure, the clinical and physiological picture is as follows. An EEG will show certain discharge patterns in one side of the brain. These being discharges referred to as epileptiform. They have a characteristic EEG feature. Actually, while that discharge pattern is going on, the patient does not behaviorally show any sign of seizure. But after this discharge pattern has gone on for some period of time, what is called a mirror focus develops. That is to say, you start getting the same discharge pattern in the mirror image part of the cerebral cortex on the other side. And as the mirror focus develops, you now start generating the characteristic epileptic seizure activity, seizure behavior. So it's when the two sides, in a kind of resonant way, are discharging that the behavioral manifestations of the seizure become obvious. Now, once that takes place, the great risk, of course, is that the patient will go into what is called a status epilepticus, that it will simply continue to the point of total physiological exhaustion and indeed death. And of course, the less grave but terribly worrisome possibility is that these seizures have a kind of functional scarring effect on the brain. Every one of these seizures is in its own right an insult to brain tissue. And so for that reason also, something has to be done to bring these under control. Now, medical or pharmacological approaches have long been effective. Dilantin was long a drug of choice. There are even more precise and more effective treatments now. But in some small fraction of the cases, a medical control proved to be impossible. And of course, what was most desired was some way of preventing the formation of the mirror focus. The idea was that the mirror focus develops because the discharge patterns on one side are sending signals through the corpus callosum and driving the other side. And when that circuit is complete, you now have the mirror focus and the full-fledged epileptic discharge. Well, of course, you might say, fine, so the best thing to do is to remove a flap of bone from the patient's head and just cut the corpus callosum. Now, obviously, this is not something you're going to do willy-nilly. Well, there had already been a quite substantial literature based on research with experimental animals in which the corpus callosum and other connections between the hemispheres had been severed. This was work done by the eminent neurobiologist, Sperry. Sperry would ultimately win the Nobel Prize for an entire career of research in neurobiology. But Roger Sperry, with a number of collaborators, including John Stamm and students over a course of years, did systematic studies of learning and perception and memory, maze learning, tests of coordination, tests of agility, animals balancing themselves on wires, a whole variety of tasks, perceptual and behavioral, in animals who had had the sectioning of the corpus callosum. What is sometimes referred to as a commissurotomy. By the way, the suffix O-T-O-M-Y, otomy, refers to the severing of pathways. So commissurotomy is a severing of the pathways that form that great commissure, whereas the suffix ectomy refers to removal. When an appendectomy is done, the appendix is removed. When a thalamotomy is done, fibers in the thalamus are simply severed. The thalamus isn't removed, but fibers are severed. So a commissurotomy is the severing of these interconnecting pathways. Well, what Sperry and his collaborators discovered is that the commissurotomized animal is, to all outward appearances, quite normal. So that, and certainly physiologically, quite healthy. There didn't seem to be, and indeed there doesn't seem to be, any profound, life-threatening, or even debilitating consequence of commissurotomies in experimental animals. They did, however, show some rather interesting perceptual peculiarities, which I won't discuss here, because I will discuss them in connection with commissurotomized human patients. Well, to make a very, very long story short, commissurotomies were done in a number of patients suffering otherwise intractable epilepsies. By intractable, I mean epilepsies that could not be brought under pharmacological or medical control and which were life-threatening. Well, what does the commissurotomized patient look like under gross examination, under clinical examination? You ask the commissurotomized patient now who has recovered postoperatively, walk across the floor, close your eyes and touch your index fingers to your nose, stand with your legs apart and hold your arms out straight. And you're looking for various signs, Romberg signs, Argyle-Robertson pupils, the usual neurological examination, two-point thresholds on the skin and perimetry to see whether the visual fields have contracted and the like. Well, again, the patients are normal. You give them memory tasks, they're fine. You give short-term tasks, they're fine. You ask them, you test for so-called organic mental syndrome. Do they know who they are? Do they have a good sense of time? What time do you think it is right now? Did you have breakfast this morning? Do you recall what you had for breakfast? Why do you think you're in the hospital? That sort of thing. And I say, in any number of ways, the patients turn up quite normal. Now you give this sort of task. You give them a split screen so that when they look at the screen, what appears to the left eye can't be seen by the right eye. What appears to the right eye can't be seen by the left eye. And you present these stimuli sufficiently eccentric to the line of regard so that you know, given the visual projections, one stimulus is going to go to the left hemisphere primarily, if not exclusively, and the other stimulus is going to be projected onto the right hemisphere. Aha! Now you might show the patient the picture of a key, let's say an automobile ignition key. You project this in such a way that that key is delivered to the dominant hemisphere. The patient can't name what he sees. Can't name it at all. In fact, can't name any object whatever. If you take the same object and put it in front of the person and ask him to pick out what it was he saw, five or six objects, one of them being the key. He has no trouble at all picking out the key. That is, there is a recognition of what the object is, and indeed there's sound knowledge of what the object is for. This is not the sort of loss that we sometimes refer to as an agnosia, where the patient actually can't interpret. It's not a form of apraxia, where the patient can't engage in certain kinds of otherwise habitual coordinated motor acts. In fact, let me mention agnosias and apraxias so you see how different these are from what the commissurotomized patient is producing. If a patient, post-stroke, for example, has what's called a visual agnosia, you do a test of visual perception, color vision, color naming, and the like. Everything turns up really quite normal. At that point, you might take out a fountain pen and say to the patient, do you see this? And the patient says, yes. And you say, what is this? And the patient starts doing something like this. While pausing is going on, you put it in the patient's hand so he can feel it. The minute the tactile cues are presented, the patient says, fountain pen. Absent the tactile information, the patient simply can't interpret visually what it is he's looking at. The tactile interpretation is flawless. The visual interpretation is virtually impossible. Now, that's what we would mean by a visual agnosia. The commissurotomized patient does not have an agnosia. The commissurotomized patient sees the thing, sees it for what it is, knows what it's for. He can't name it. Now, what about an apraxia? Well, with an apraxia, you might have a patient whose sensory motor performance looks just fine. If you ask the patient to touch the tip of the nose with an index finger, there's no trouble. Sometimes you ask the patient to step back and to turn hands over and palms over on the thighs as quickly as possible. You look for some lagging on one side versus the other. This is perfectly normal in the commissurotomized patient, and it's usually normal in the apraxic. What the apraxic often has is what might be called an interpretive motor problem, so that you say to the apraxic, the apraxic might not have a jacket on. You hand him a laboratory coat or a jacket, and you say, would you put this on for me? And you'll find him very much like the visual agnosic, sort of handling the thing and looking at the thing and maybe twisting it a bit and moving it to one side or the other, but simply can't go through the habitual, well-trained behavior of getting an arm in the sleeve and getting the jacket on. Now, I say, this is not the sort of thing you get with commissurotomized patients. If you now reverse the presentation so that the projected object is going to the Broca's area side, the patient names it immediately, names it accurately. What you're getting here is very definitely the distinction between linguistic functions being served by one side of the brain and non-linguistic, much more visual functions being served by the other side. Now, the patient can point to things correctly. He subsequently can tell you when he sees them with both eyes, no trouble at all, that's a key, this is what it's for, indeed it's my own key. So it's only under these unusual circumstances that the person can perceive but not name, because the naming function requires linguistic abilities matching up with what is perceived, and as a result of the commissurotomy, the perceptual information is not getting to the side where the language mediation is going on. Now, I think it's quite important to re-examine the question, is language on the dominant side? Is language only in one side? When these findings first came out, most of the writers were arguing as if there were a little box inside one half of the cerebral cortex, and that box was labeled language, and anything linguistic was going to come out of that box, and it would have to go into that box, and that box was on one side only. Any number of studies indicated this sort of thing. For example, with significant damage on the language side of the brain, subjects have no trouble understanding and telling you what a melody is, but they have trouble with lyrics, for example, so that you could actually partition out the linguistic and the melodic part of an input depending on whether it was the language side that was disturbed. The best evidence now is that indeed there is a far richer disposition toward linguistic functions on one side of the brain, that those functions are more lateralized. Indeed, recent evidence suggests that on average women have a rather more elaborated linguistic side than relatively men do. I mean, these of course are quite average and indeed provisional data. But there clearly are linguistic functions on both sides, and the more sophisticated we become in testing for linguistic functions, the more obvious it is that there really is a bilateral representation of linguistic function, even if there's a disproportionate representation on one side only. Is Chomsky right, then? Is the universal generative grammar expressive of underlying brain mechanisms and entirely innate? Well, let's put it this way. There does seem to be a genetically predetermined pattern of information processing on one side of the brain, the form of processing that is disproportionately involved in linguistic functions. Now, I don't think that confirms a theory like Chomsky's. There are other ways of accounting for these effects, but the general Chomskyan idea that some significant aspect of language does not arise from learning, but is there at the outset, is confirmed by data of this sort. Thanks.